Okay, here we are. Welcome, everybody. It is now 6 o'clock here on the West Coast. For those of you who are in colder weather and easterner weather, it is now either 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock, or whatever time you may have. My name is Yitzhak Et Shalom, and I'm excited to be participating in this webcast as we study together a piece of this week's parasha, Parashat Vayeshev. I'd like to take a look together, and I hope that you all have the handout that is available. If you look on the bulletin board, you can see where to get it from. This week's handout, we're going to be taking a look, although you will be able to participate fairly fully if you have a Tanakh in front of you. Having the Sefer Bereishit, the Book of Genesis, will be helpful, but will not take you all the way through the shiur. Welcome to those of you who are just joining us. What I will request is that this shiur, this will be made in segments, and therefore I'll request that hold questions, if those of you who have mics and would like to participate, which I would love, to hold the questions until we get to the end of a segment, and I'll ask if there's any questions. Those of you who are submitting chat questions, I will address them after the shiur is over. It may be best if you sent me your email address so that I can do so after we are done. The beginning of Parshat Vayeshev is really the beginning of the last four parshiot in Sefer Bereishit, the last four sections of the Book of Genesis, which are the story properly spoken of Yosef. And that is that, take a very quick overview of the Book of Bereishit, the first 11 chapters are what we might refer to as the primeval history, and that belongs to a whole different shiur, why it's referred to that way. Chapters 12 through roughly 22 or 23, we'd see where we would want to divide them. 23 are really the story of Abraham. Perhaps we would argue that 24 through 26, the story of Yitzchak, whether he has a separate section. And then 27 through 36, roughly spoken, is the parshiot of Yaakov. From here to the end of the book, the focus of the story is Yosef. The camera, as it were, remember I'm from Hollywood, the camera, as it were, follows Yosef from his youth all the way until the very end of the Book of Bereishit with his death and mummification in Egypt. So we're beginning the story of Yosef. And at the beginning of the story of Yosef, the first few verses detail his difficult relationship with his brothers, which seems to be provoked or instigated by his father's favoritism for him. So let's take a look. Yisrael ahavet Yosef mikol banav, kiven zkunim hu lo. We have to take a look at what that phrase means. So I've put a translation here. The translation itself may not be all that helpful, because I wrote Yisrael loved Yosef more than any of his other sons, kiven zkunim hu lo. Now the end of that verse is one that is very famous. I elided it here, but it's one that actually is going to play a role in what we're going to take a look at. The end of that verse is V'asalo ketonet pasim. Yaakov made a ketonet pasim for Yosef as an expression of, as a result of his favoritism of Yosef over the other brothers. What is a ketonet pasim? We'll look at that in a minute. But let's start with the first difficult phrase, kiven zikunim hulo. And believe it or not, translating that phrase properly and understanding what it means will have a large impact on how we understand much of the rest of the story. Ben Zekunim could be interpreted, the way that it's used colloquially in Hebrew today, as a child of the old age. Meaning, a parent has a child when the parent is elderly, especially if the parent has other children who were born when he was young, that child is called a Ben Zekunim. That's how we refer to it today in Hebrew. The question is, what does it mean in this context? That's the approach taken by Rashi. The Onkelos in the Targum says, Ben Zekunim means Bar Chakim, a wise son. And he interprets the Zikunim not as elderly, but rather as wise, but likely because he's bothered by the challenge that the Ramban raises to Rashi. The Ramban raises the following challenge. He says, why would we refer to Yosef as a Ben Zikunim when, after all, he's not the youngest son? And not only that, but Yosef is not all that much younger than Yisachar Zvulun, maybe a year or two. Whereas Binyamin is at least 6 years younger than Yosef, read through the chronology in Parshat Vayetze, and Binyamin indeed is a real Ben Zekunim. So why is Yosef singled out for that? So the Ramban makes a suggestion which has a very interesting anthropological approach to it, in that he takes a page from at least what he understands to be the history of clans. Because remember, when we're talking about Yaakov and his family, we are not talking about a nation. We're also not talking about a normal family. We're talking about a clan. We're talking about 13 children. We're talking about slaves. We're talking about multiple wives. And as a result, it's really a large extended family, which you might refer to as a shevet, almost as a tribe. And, of course, there is the nasi, the head of the tribe, the pater familias is referred to, which is Yaakov. Ramban makes the following claim. He says that in clans like this, the head of the family would take a young son and would appoint him to be his, if you will, almost his personal valet, who would spend time with him and walk with him and take care of him and serve him in his old age, but also that this paterfamilias, the head of the family, would pass on all of the secret family lore and stories to this son. And that's who Yosef was. This is the Ramban's take on Ben Zikunim. We're going to use that in interpreting something that becomes very difficult a little bit later on in the story. Okay, Ketonet Pasim. This is just an opportunity to point out an important piece of methodology in studying Tanakh. I'm a teacher of Tanakh, and I teach in high school and adults. And as a result, I find that it is as important, if not more important, to teach the methodology of study as it is to teach the material itself. Because once we're armed with a proper methodology and a proper approach to studying Tanakh, then often we are enabled to do more and more studying on our own, to raise some of our own questions, perhaps to even suggest some of our own approaches and understandings and to the solutions. One common pitfall that we have is that we read the Tanakh, and those of us who are familiar with Hebrew, especially those of us who are familiar with modern Hebrew, as a conversational language, make the mistake of reading the Tanakh as if it were written in modern Hebrew. And as such, we interpret words that are 3,000 years old or more as if they are words in their conventional, common, modern usage. A classic example of this is the word na, nun aleph. The word na in modern Hebrew means please. Na laha aver pamelach. Those of us who grew up at Hebrew-speaking camps learned to ask to pass something at the table. And yet the word na in Tanakh never means that. As the Ebenezer points out, the word na in Tanakh means now. Countless examples of that. To bring it back home, what is a ketonet pasim? So according to Andrew Lloyd Webber, and according to everything we all grew up with, a ketonet pasim means a multicolored coat, a coat of many colors, or at least a coat of stripes. So we assume the stripes to be different colored stripes. Why do we think that? Because the word pasim in modern Hebrew means stripes. The word pasim in rabbinic Hebrew does mean vertical pieces. It could be vertical structures or vertical stripes. That's what pasim means. A pasim does not mean that in Tanakh. In biblical Hebrew, which is a related but not exactly the same language as rabbinic Hebrew, pasim means something which reaches all the way to the pas hayad, to the, and I'll try to show this in the camera, all the way to the wrist. So that you have a ketonet that goes all the way and covers the palm of the hand. What kind of people would wear a garment that covered all the way to their hand and made their hand inaccessible? Be people who are not involved in manual labor. What sort of people are those? Well, we pull out the most important tool that any commentator on Tanakh uses, which is the concordance. We open up the concordance and see that the ketonet pasim appears not only here in the Yosef story, in several places. It also appears in Shmuel Bet Perek Yud Gimel, in the story of the tragedy and the awful attack of Amnon on his somewhat sister Tamar. And in that attack, after Tamar is attacked and then sent away from Amnon's rooms, those who wish to read it, take a look in Shmuel Bet Perek Yud Gimel. Tamar is anguished, she's upset, she's sad, and her reaction is to tear her garment. What does the text say? That ketonet hapasim asher aleha karaha. The ketonet pasim that she wore, she tore, and then the text says, ki chen tobashna benot hamelach. This is what daughters of the king wear. In other words, ketonet pasim is a clothing of royalty. Why? Because royalty doesn't need to work. So now we get a very different picture of what's happening with Yosef. It's not just that he got a nice jacket. Yosef was given a garment of royalty by his father, which then explains the brother's reaction to the first dream. So now let's get into the meat, as it were, of the shiur. Yosef, as we saw, does not get along with his brothers. The brothers can't speak peaceably to him. And then Yosef has a dream. Let's pick up at that point. Yosef has a dream, and he decides to tell his brothers about the dream. It says, Shimuna Achalom Azer Asher Chalamti. Listen now, again, to this dream that I dreamt. V'hine anachru me'almim alumim betoch hasadeh, v'hine kama alumati v'gan nitzava, v'hine tesuben alumotechem v'tishtachaven al alumati. First question, of course, is why does Yosef want to tell his brothers his dream? After all, his brothers can't speak peaceably to him. Yosef can't be that dense that he doesn't understand that there's enmity. Why would he exacerbate it by telling them a dream which clearly favors him? But we have to understand that in the ancient world, dreams were understood. Correct. It's a good point Anochi brings up, which is that the dreams involved them, but still, how do we understand what dreams are? If I have a dream and it involves somebody else and it puts the other person in a bad position and it's somebody who I desire to have a good relationship with, I'm not going to exacerbate that relationship by sharing that dream with him. Except that in the ancient world, of course, dreams were perceived as something very differently. They were perceived not as a personal psychological dream as we would today, but rather, perhaps, as a form of prophecy. And as such, Yosef says, look, this is a dream that involves you. I know about your destiny. And so therefore, I'm going to tell you about it. I think you would be interested in it. The brother's reaction must have shocked Yosef. And what is their reaction? The reaction is, Hamaloch tingloch alenu imashol tingshol banu. You think to rule over us. And now we understand why that's their first reaction. He's wearing a royal garment. You think to be king over us. You think to rule over us. And then they hated him more for his dreams and for his telling them. Al-Khalotav, the Al-Dvarav. They hated him for his dreams, but they also hated him for the fact that he shared the dreams, the fact that he told them the dreams. Now, let's take a look at this and see what it means. The first thing, of course, is to ask, what does the dream mean? And here is where we always get misled. You ask the average person on the street who's familiar with the Bible, whether they're Jewish or not, they're familiar with the story. They say to you, Joseph had dreams. Yeah, okay, what was the first dream? So if you jog the memory a little bit, they say, oh, the sheaves. Good. I said, what does the dream mean? They say, well, it means Joseph's going to rule over them. But we don't know that. All we know is that that's the interpretation that the brothers gave. The brothers said, do you think you're going to rule over us? So the brothers interpreted the dream that way. Why would we think that that's what the dream really means? And that problem gets much more severe in the second dream, which we'll look at in a couple minutes, and in the interpretation of the second dream. But let's take a look at the first dream itself. The first dream is presented in three stages, each stage marked off with the word Vihine. So we have Vihine, number one, we are binding sheaves together in the field. Number two is that my sheaf stands up, the third one is that your sheaves turn around and bow to my sheaf. That's his dream. He doesn't give an interpretation. He presents the dream, and the brothers give it that twist. Well, let's see what the dream actually means. Dreams, of course, are presented in symbolic language. All of the dreams that we see in the Yosef cycle, which are three sets of dreams, Yosef's two dreams, the two dreams of the butler and the baker, and the two dreams of Pharaoh, are all in symbolic imagery. In Pharaoh's dreams, for instance, the cows represent years. In the butler, the baker's dreams, the three represent 3 days. So what is the symbolism here? Well, for somebody who lives on the land, wheat represents subsistence, represents economic survival, if you will. And so how does Yosef present his dream? The first part of the dream is, Anachnu me'almim alumim b'tal chasadeh. We're binding sheaves in the field. What's the second piece of it? My sheaf stands up and is erect. And the third one is that all of your sheaves bow to my sheaf. Right? So what could that mean in dream imagery? Ignoring for a moment, and perhaps forever, the twist that the brothers gave to it and their spin, as it were, and their interpretation. It seems to be, quite simply, that because wheat, in that context and in any almost any context, is representative of food and of survival, what Yosef says is, first, stage one is, we are working together. We're working together on a common economic venture. Stage two, my economic status rises tall, higher than yours. And stage three is you all bow to me. Now here's Rav Elchanan Samet, a teacher of mine in Israel, made a suggestion, which I think is a very important suggestion. We're willing to interpret the sheaves, even the brothers interpret the sheaves, as being symbolic. In the second dream, we interpret the sun and the moon as being symbolic, the stars as symbolic. But in every one of the responses, we don't interpret bowing as being symbolic. And yet, bowing is as much part of the language of dreams as is wheat or stars. So what does bowing represent? So we see bowing in Tanakh. Bowing doesn't mean, by the way, just moving your head as I'm doing here on the screen, but it means lying flat on, I will not do this on the screen, lying flat on the ground, as we do on Yom Kippur, lying flat on the ground in front of another person. So when do we bow? So we find in Tanakh that people bow to worship. People bow, and sometimes that worship is not pleasing, it's the wrong kind of worship. People bow out of respect. When Moshe meets Yitro, he bows to him. People bow out of dependence or out of fear. People bow before Yosef. The brothers bow before Yosef. And people bow out of gratitude and dependence, such as when Abraham bows in front of Ephron in the middle of the negotiations after having bowed in front of the representatives of the Chittim when he's trying to buy Me'arat HaMachpelah. So now let's put that back into our imagery in the... In the interpretation of the dream. What does Yosef say? We are working together in an economic venture. At a particular point, my economic status will rise above yours, and then you will be dependent on me for your survival. This, by the way, is exactly what played out, exactly what happened later on in Egypt when Yosef rose to greatness, and the brothers all depended on him, as did most of the Middle East, for their physical survival. So the brothers' take on it really is not what played out, but that was not necessarily the proper interpretation of the dream. And that addresses the subtext of this entire story, which is, once we've heard the dreams, how do we understand them? Are they prophecy? Are they a projection of Yosef's own wishes? Are they a mix of the two? Well, at least as far as the first dream goes, it seems quite clear that they are a form of prophecy. But now let's take a look at the second dream. But note that the brothers' reaction to this dream is a reaction of anger. They are angry at him. And you can hear it in the words. Notice also that Yosef did not share this dream with his father. He only told his brothers. At least that's what we're told. Now, take a look at the next piece of the text. V'achalom od chalom acher, v'yisaper oto le'achav. Again, he had another dream. And he told his brothers. And again, this is a very strange thing, because after telling him the last dream, why would he tell him this dream? Vayomer, hinei chalamti chalom od, I had another dream. Hinei shemesh vayareach l'chanasar kochavim mishtachavim li. The sun, the moon, and 11 stars are bowing to me. Now this dream is radically different than the first one. First of all, we have a particular number. Beforehand, it's your sheaves. So whoever he was talking to, they have sheaves. Might have been five, six of his brothers, might have been all 11 of his brothers, might have been 10 of them, we don't know. In this dream, there's a number, 11 stars. There's also a sun and a moon. But what the real critical difference is that Yosef is not represented by a star. Yosef is Yosef. And the stars and the sun and the moon are bowing to him. Now, notice that the brothers do not react, at least not vocally. Who does react? By Saper el Aviv ve'el Achav. So we know that he told his brothers, but we find out that he also told his father. Garbo Aviv. And father... I'll share this with you. Somebody just sent in, and I'm going to respond to this right away, the question about Rachel wasn't even alive. So I'll ask the question back. Why would you think that Rachel's even a part of this dream? Why are you reacting and saying, well, Rachel's not even alive. Where is Rachel in the dream? There's no Rachel in the dream. There's a sun and moon and stars. And here's where we get misled again. Watch what happens. He tells his father and he tells his brothers. Vayigabo aviv, father gets angry. Notice, brothers are quiet, father gets angry. Vayomer lo, ma chalom hazeh asher chalamta. What is this dream? Havon avo anivim cha v'achacha l'shtachalot l'charetza. Do you think I and your mother and your brothers are going to come and bow to you? And as Rashi points out, mother, after all, is dead, so it's impossible. But of course, father Yaakov doesn't necessarily mean it in that way, because then he would just point to the fact that Rachel's dead. He's saying, what, do you think we're all going to bow to you? You're the nearly youngest son, and you think I am going to bow to you, and your brothers are going to bow to you? But of course, just like we had before with the sheaves, who said that that's what the dream means? And here the question becomes much more severe. Think about it. In this particular dream, we don't have a bunch of sheaves, and sheaves bow to one sheaf, in which case the sheaves could be representative of people, in which case people are bowing to a person, and the people are the brothers, and the person is Yosef. Here we have stars, the sun and the moon, bowing to Yosef, not to a star, not to a sun or a moon, but rather to Yosef himself. So, it's not necessarily the case that the stars and the sun and the moon represent people. It could be that they are themselves the sun, the moon, and the stars. And let's take a look. Now, somebody has pointed out in their chat, and I appreciate the comments, it's fun to do this back and forth, is that Jacob misinterpreted the dream? First of all, why not? Second of all, I'm not so sure if you look at the text and the next pasuk, which is not on the handout, that Yaakov was necessarily presenting how he really understood it, but perhaps he was trying to quiet down the tension that he might have felt between the brothers and Yosef, and perhaps to indicate also that he didn't have as much favoritism as they thought, perhaps to cool the tensions. In other words, maybe Yaakov himself didn't read it this way. And why am I saying that? Because the next pasuk is, "Vaykanu bo echav v'aviv shamar tadavar." Yaakov's words are, this is impossible. And yet Yaakov shamar tadavar, which means Yaakov waited to see what would happen. He didn't forget about it. He didn't throw it out and ignore it. He said, well, what's going to happen? In the meantime, the brother's reaction is odd. The brothers don't react with anger as they did after the first dream. Rather, they are jealous. Huge difference between anger and jealousy. Anger is something that you would have when you feel threatened, when you feel belittled, when you feel, in this case, that someone's lording themselves over you out and it's not an appropriate position. Jealousy is when you accept the fact that someone else has a great position, you just aren't happy about it. And so Vaykanu Vo Achad seems to say that the brothers have now accepted the idea that that Yosef is going to rule over them or be higher than them or whatever it may be, and they're not happy about it. In time, father was angry, suddenly father's watching what's going on. Where did this all come from? So before we get into the interpretation of the second dream, with which I think we'll have a lot of fun, I'd like to go back to a later scene at the end of our parsha. Because if you take a look at Parshat Vayeshev, you realize that Parshat Vayeshev begins and ends with a very similar piece, which is two dreams, interpretation, and the interpretation with obviously very big consequences. The two that we know, we just saw, and at the end of the parsha, and you see it in the second source on the page, you have the butler and the baker. Anybody who's interested, this is not on our topic, but take a look at the Sforno in his presentation of who was in prison and who actually did not do their job properly in Pharaoh's court. See something very interesting and a very careful read of the text. But to our point, they have a dream. Yosef is in charge of the prisoners in the royal prison, what we would call Club Fed. And you have the butler and the baker there, and they have a dream in the same night, and they wake up and they're upset. They're upset. And Yosef asked them what's bothering them, and they say, we have dreams. He said, okay, tell me the dreams. And then he says a very strange statement. Halo le'elohim pitronim sapru na li. What does that mean? The solutions belong to God, tell me. Yosef certainly can't be claiming that he is a god, and he certainly can't claim that he has some sort of automatic prophecy that wherever he's asked, he can open up a channel and get some information from God. That doesn't make any sense. So what does Yosef mean, halo l'Elohim pitronim, sapru na li? In other words, why would Yosef think that he had any particular talent in interpreting dreams that he opens up to the butler and baker and says, Tell me what your dream is, and I'll tell you. Why would he think that? Somebody thinks, oh, Yosef dreams. But that is a very inaccurate statement. Yosef and dreams, from the beginning of the parsha, is not Yosef interpreting dreams. It's Yosef having dreams. And by the way, all the interpretations are given by others. So why would Yosef think that he knows how to interpret dreams? Very strange. The answer comes in the third of the dream couplets. And that shows, and that appears as the fourth source on the page. When Paro has his two dreams, and the Tsar Mashkin, the butler, and comes to him and says, at Chatayim in Azkirayom, there was a boy with us in prison, and he speaks very disparagingly of Yosef, and he says that we had a dream, and he interpreted it, came exactly that way. Yosef is immediately rushed out of the pit, and Paro tells his dreams to Yosef, and Yosef then says, in the interpretation, and he says, the seven cows and the seven sheaves are one dream, the seven fat cows and the seven good sheaves are seven good years, and the seven lean cows and the seven rotten sheaves, if you will, are seven bad years. It gives an interpretation which puts the dreams together. Which leaves us with one question. If that's the case, why are the two dreams? And Yosef answers it. The Ali Shanot Hachalom, the El Paro, the fact that the dream was doubled to Paro, because this matter is fixed before God, and God's going to make it happen very quickly. In other words, the fact that the dream was doubled confirms the reality of this prophecy, as it were. Where did Yosef get this information from? So now we have to roll backwards. Yosef, in interpreting Paro's dream, and interprets it very smoothly and very comfortably, does so with this information that he then shares with Paro, which is the doubling of the dream, confirms the reality of the dream, the reality of the prophecy, as it were. We then move backwards to the scene at the end of Parsha Vayeshev, where he interprets the dreams of the butler and the baker, which he does, again, very smoothly and very comfortably. Where did he get this information from? So let's go back to our original scene. Before we take apart the second dream, let's go back to our original, to our scene. What happened when Yosef had his first dream? So let's remember, and those of you who joined us a little bit later, we're utilizing the Ramban's approach to understanding Ben Zikunim. The Ben Zikunim Hu Lo means that Yosef was Yaakov's private valet, and that Yaakov passed on all of the secret information that he had to Yosef. He was going to be the bearer of the family tradition, as it were. Who was the first one in our family who was given prophecy through dreams, as opposed to prophecy? So, of course, we know that Abraham had a machazeh. The question is what that means. But, of course, famously, it was Yaakov. Yaakov had the chalom. We're told that it's called a chalom, the vision at Beit El. And in Aram, the malach comes in a chalom, that shows him the goats and the stripe and the spotted goats, and tells him it's time to come home. So Yaakov has had a chalomot. So what has Yaakov passed on to Yosef? A dream is a prophecy. Very good. So Yosef, wearing his royal clothes, has a dream, assumes it's a prophecy, shares it with his brothers. Got to be shocked at the fact that the brothers don't respond very appropriately to hearing prophecy that affects them, but rather get angry at him, and they accuse him of the dream being not prophecy, but rather an expression of his own inner desire and fantasy, which is to rule over them. Yosef must be taken aback after what he learned from Yaakov. And then a much stranger thing happens. He has a second dream. For some reason, he decides to share this again. And this time, brothers are silent. And the brothers are jealous. And by the way, how do the brothers react later on when Yosef is alone with them in Dothan? Here's the dream guy. Let's kill him and see what happens to his dreams. But it sounds as if they're taking his dreams seriously and they're almost contending with a destiny that's written for him. However, father, who's hearing the dream for the first time, meaning the second dream is the first thing that Yaakov heard, begins by getting angry at him. The next pasuk says the brothers are jealous, and father is watching to see what's going to happen. What's going on? Yosef is now slouch. Yosef is watching all of this. What does he see? He shared one dream with his brothers, and they got angry. Surprise. He shares a second dream. Brothers are silent. Father gets angry. Father looks at the brothers, sees their jealousy, and father suddenly falls silent also. Yosef has to put all this together and figure out what's going on. He understands the following. That when a person has a dream, and this may not be true about his father Yaakov, but it's become true for him. When a person has a dream, it may be a prophecy. It may also be an expression of his own personal psychological desires, needs, fantasies, etc. Could be either way. However, when a person has a dream doubled, meaning he has two dreams with essentially the same message, in some way it's doubled, then he should understand that that's really prophecy. That explains why brothers, when they hear the second dream, fall silent and become jealous. That explains why father, when he hears the second dream, but to him it's the first, gets angry. That explains why father, watching the brothers get jealous, must understand that Yosef must have shared an earlier dream. This can't be the first one. That's why the brothers aren't getting angry. And father, shamar tadavar. Yosef has now understood a lesson about dream interpretation. And here's the critical piece. When you're interpreting dreams, there's two ways to go. The typical way that a psychoanalyst would deal with dreams is to say, well, I need to understand who you are, your background, your relationship with your parents, early experiences, etc., to understand what your deep-seated fears and desires are and how they would play out in this dream in order to interpret why you're having these kind of dreams. That is a subjective dream, which is very much geared by who is having the dream and what their background is. And that, nobody off the street can interpret, nobody who just meets you can interpret, see somebody who knows you very well, or a Navi. However, if the dream is prophecy, then it's going to be presented in a presentation or in a language which is objectively accessible. Yeah, you have to understand the context, you have to perhaps be living in that culture to understand what particular things mean, like bowing and sheaves, but it's not something that depends on the person's individual background. So what happens? Yosef wakes up in prison one day, or comes into the prison one day, and sees these two guys waking up, and they both had dreams in the same night. As we say in Hebrew, Asimon Nafal. Yosef figured out. He said, okay, if having two dreams of the same type by one person represents that it's really a prophecy, then likely two people having a dream in one night could obviously upset them both, and these are guys who are curiously and coincidentally in very common circumstances. In other words, both servants of Paro who both have sinned in food preparation and they're both in prison together, and I've been put in charge of them, then it's very likely that what we have here is a doubled dream. Okay? And so what does he say? Halo le'lohim pitronim, your solutions belong to God, sapun ali. What he means is, since after all this is a prophecy, lay it out on the table. It'll be very, very obvious. And by the way, once they do so, it is obvious. Because, as we find out, 3 days later is Paro's birthday. Yom HaLedet Paro. It's Paro's birthday in 3 days. That means, and everybody knows about that, and a birthday is a time when the king gives amnesty and judges his people. So when each of the butler and baker present a three in their dream, well, that becomes easy. That represents time. That's 3 days. The second thing is that the butler is serving wine to Paro. Well, that's easy. That means that Paro is going to reinstate him, and he's going to continue drinking from him. On the other hand, the baker is standing there almost like he's hanging, and birds are eating bread out of baskets on his head. That certainly doesn't compare very, very favorably with the other dreams. Again, the three baskets, 3 days, that's easy. Again, the second set of the set of dreams by the butler and the baker are just, they walk through by themselves once you realize this principle. And then Yosef comes to Paro, here's these two dreams, here's the similarities, here's prophecy. I don't need to know about Paro's background and about his particular fears. All I need to know, and this is an important piece of information, is that the economy of Egypt rests in part of Egypt on grazing, on cattle, and the other on wheat, which is why, parenthetically, the pharaohs in their sarcophagi were buried with, in some cases, a scythe, and in other cases, a cattle prod. So once you know that about Egypt, you understand, these are representative of the economy of Egypt, and therefore, they're all one dream, they're all one prophecy, and it's easy to interpret. Okay, so much so for the issue of Yosef and interpreting dreams. But now to understand what the second dream is. This is really where the critical piece is. The second dream, the sun and the moon, again, were interpreted by Yaakov, and perhaps he didn't even mean it this way, but this is what Yaakov said, that it represents the sun and the moon, the father, the mother, and the 11 brothers. And that of course is impossible. But we don't know that to be the case at all. And let's see if we can get a different take on this. There's a key pasuk in the whole dream scenario, or the dream, the aftermath of the dreams, that we see in the middle of page one, and it's source number three. There's no numbers on here, but it's the third source. When the brothers come down to Egypt, they come down years later to get food, Yosef sees them, and he remembers the dreams they dreamt lahem. We'll have to see what that means. And what does he say? He says, you are miraglim, you are spies. And he begins the whole process that he basically harasses and terrorizes them, and they end up having to come down with Binyamin and that whole story. But what is the connection between remembering the dreams? What is that about? Some Rishonim say he thought that it was his job to make the dreams come true when he had to activate them. But perhaps there's a different way to look at this. The first dream and the second dream, as we've already seen, are linked. The first dream is a dream about material success, material subsistence, and material support, meaning that Yosef would be the one who would take care of the brothers. It was his job. They would all bow to him, meaning they'd be dependent on him, and he would give them support. However, support for the family comes in, as it were, two shades. There's material support, but there's also support, what we might call spiritual support, meaning support for the mission of who this family is supposed to be. This family is a family whose great-grandfather made this very special brief with Hashem, that their job is to teach the entire world, to bring the world to a realization of who God is, etc. And now Yosef realizes that very first thing is that he's going to be responsible for their financial, economic, and material well-being and salvation. Now, what do stars represent? Because let's go back to the fact that this is a dream, and we're using dream imagery. What do stars represent? Stars, as we know from Sefer Bereishit, represent the fortunes of the children of Abraham. When Abraham says to God, you're giving me the land, what is it worth? I have no one to inherit. God takes him outside, says, count the stars, that's how many your children will be. And several times he's promised that your children will be as numerous as the stars. The stars represent Abraham's children. What of the sun and the moon? We're going to see that later. But if Yosef has the stars bowing to him, and we borrow bowing from the previous dream as saying bowing represents dependence, then that means that not only are the brothers going to be dependent on Yosef for their material well-being, but they will also be dependent on Yosef for their spiritual well-being. That Yosef will be in charge of making sure that they survive and ultimately achieve their spiritual potential and their spiritual destiny. But Yosef remembers the dreams. He remembers this particular job. We'll get to the sun and the moon. But he remembers this particular job. So what happens when the brothers come down? He remembers the dreams. Asher chalam lahem. What does chalam lahem mean? Not that he dreamed about them, but that he dreamed, as it were, on their behalf. The dreams that he dreamt that affected them. And he remembered what his job was. So he began this manipulation, and he can't call it anything but a manipulation, in order to get the brothers to all move down to Egypt, somehow understanding that with his position of power, he would be able to guarantee not only their material, but also their spiritual and covenantal continuity and success in Egypt. And so he did what he did to get them down. And Yosef indeed admits to this. At the end of his life, what does he say? Take a look at the bottom of page one. Vayeshev Yosef Mitzrayim hu veit aviv. Yosef and his father's house lived in Egypt. Vayechi Yosef me'av 10 shanim. Now, something interesting about the text here is that it says that Yosef lived 110 years. That's nothing unusual, although he is the only one of two of the brothers that we hear their lifespan, he and Levi. And he says, I'm about to die. He says, God will remember you, and God will bring you up from this land to the land that he promised, etc. And then my father said, Israel, he made them take an oath that when God takes them out, they would take his bones with them. He has to be buried in Egypt. He wants to be reinterred in Israel when they leave. And of course, that's what happens in the beginning of Parshat Mishalach. Now, notice, Vayamu Yosef ben Mi'ala Eser Shanim. The text, again, tells us that he lived 110 years. And they involved him, and they put him in a coffin in Egypt, and they remained. And that is the very end of Sefer Bereishit. Yosef is, as far as I know, the only one in Tanakh, besides the repetitions of Divrei Hayamim, whose lifespan is given to us twice by the narrative. Even Moshe Rabbeinu, where the text says that he lived 120 years, himself says, I'm 120 years old, but he said it once, and the text says it once. But the narration, the text, as it were, only says the Moshe Rabbeinu's lifespan at one time. However, Yosef, for some reason, his lifespan is mentioned twice. I'm curious. Yosef also, the very last thing he says, is about God remembering them and bringing them back to the land. Because Yosef, of course, understands that that is his job. His job cannot be completed in Egypt, and he has not been able to fully complete his job in his lifetime of guaranteeing the spiritual success of his family with which he was entrusted. Okay? So that leaves us with a question about the second dream, and how the second dream ever comes to fruition, how the second dream is ever realized, or if it is. So then I'll ask you to turn the page. Yosef had a descendant. Yosef's son, of course, was Ephraim. Ephraim had a descendant, a member of his tribe, who was the leader of Bnei Yisrael as they entered Eretz Yisrael. His name was Hoshea bin Nun, and Moshe renamed him Yehoshua. Yehoshua bin Nun. Yosef, if you recall, asked Bnei Yisrael to bury him, to go back and reinter him in Eretz Yisrael. They bring the bones. They bring the bones through the desert. They bring the bones into the land. Remember, Yosef is then going to end up being buried in Shechem, in that area that was bought by Yaakov, in Shechem. Bnei Yisrael arrive in Shechem at the very latest, after the conquest of Ha'ai, at the end of Perek Chet. And yet, take a look at the first source on page 2. Vahi acharei advarim ha'ele, vayamot Yehoshua binun eved Adonai ben me'av eser shanim. Notice the years. Yehoshua, who finally, at the end of his life, is given the title that Moshe was given at the end of his life, Eved Hashem, dies at the age of 110, and after he dies, V'yatatzmot Yosef asher halu v'nei yisom mitzrayim kavru b'shchem b'chokat ha'sodeh, etc. Yosef's bones are reinterred. Now, I'm not concerned with whether or not this text is in order. In other words, this text may indeed be reflecting something that happened years earlier that they buried Yosef. What intrigues me is the fact that the text decides to mention it here. In other words, only after Yeshua dies are we told about the reinterment of Yosef in Shechem. Why is that the case? Because again, Yosef's job was to bring Bnei Yisrael back to Eretz Yisrael with material success and survival in Egypt, but with spiritual commitment and with a full ability to realize their potential, which of course could never happen outside of Israel, and could certainly not happen while slaves in Egypt. This could not be completed by Yosef in his lifetime. So, as it were, he entrusted it to one of his descendants. Yehoshua would finish the job, and Yehoshua would be the one to bring them into the land, to conquer the land, and to settle the people in the land. And as it were, whether or not chronologically is the way it happens, textually the text presents the reinterment of Yosef after Yeshua's death, as if to say that Yeshua, throughout his entire career, was continuing the process that Yosef had begun, and only when his career was over with his death could Yosef finally be put to rest. And indeed is the way that it happens. And we're left with one conundrum. What do we do with the sun and the moon in Yosef's dream? The stars, we've solved. And again, we solved it in a way that somewhat accepted Yaakov's interpretation that the stars represent the suns, but not in a way of bowing as in obeisance or subservience, but rather in a sense of dependence. And the stars here not representing the suns as people, but the suns as their finest spiritual qualities. Very good. What do we do with the sun and the moon? There is a wondrous passage in Yehoshua Perek Yod. It's the second passage on page 2. Yehoshua fights the first real all-out battle against five kings who have made an alliance and have gone to attack the city of Givon, just north of Yerushalayim, northwest of Yerushalayim, because the Givonim have surrendered to Yehoshua through their masquerade, read Yehoshua Tet, and have signed a peace treaty. And these five kings make an alliance to attack the Givonim for their treachery, but also because that will force Yehoshua and his people to come to their aid because of their treaty, and will allow them to fight Yehoshua and Bnei Israel on their own terms, where and when they decide. This is what happens. And in Perek Yod, as you can see, they come up and attack Givon. Yehoshua brings the army up throughout the night and attacks them. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets involved in the attack, and take a look on the last pasuk of the small print. Vahim and Usam and Bnei Israel, Haim and Murad Beit Choron, they're running down Murad Beit Choron. It's right off of Road 443, if you're interested. Vagunai Shlich Alehem Avanim Gdolot Min HaShemayim. God threw down huge boulders from the sky. We find out that they're not boulders in a minute. Ad Azekah, all the way south to Azekah. Vayamutu, and they died. Rabim HaShemetu Be'avnei HaBarad, we find out that they're hailstones. More people died from the hailstones than Bnei Israel killed with the sword. And then Yehoshua comes and sings a song. And this piece itself is very difficult and deserves a shiur by itself, but there's one piece of this that we can utilize for our purposes, and I see we only have a few minutes left. I do want to leave a few minutes for Q&A. Yehoshua sang the following song. And he said, Shemesh b'Givon Dom v'Areach v'Emek Ayalon. The sun should stand still in Givon, and the moon should stand still in the valley of Ayalon. And the text says, V'Yidom HaShemesh v'Areach Hamad Ad Yikom Goy Oivad. The sun stood still, the moon stood still, until the nation was able to take vengeance from its enemy. Halohi Chtuval Sefer Yashar. After all, this is written in Sefer Yashar. Now, was Yehoshua commanding the sun to stand still? Whatever that may mean. And the Rishonim are all over the place with this because of the obvious physics difficulty. Nonetheless, was Yehoshua, whatever it may mean, asking the sun to stand still in order to keep the day longer, as some suggest, in order to keep the sun in the eyes of the fleeing enemy to catch them, as others suggest? Unclear. What is clear is that he asked the heavens to stop orbiting in some fashion in order to be able to win the war. And the text says that it happened. HaKadosh Baruch Hu obeyed, as it were, Yehoshua, or as we're going to see in a moment, and everything stood still. And this is something that's written about in Sefer HaYashar. What is Sefer HaYashar? So Ibn Ezra and his school believe that Sefer HaYashar is one of many books that existed at the time of Tanakh that we no longer have, like Sefer Melchamot Hashem, and Sefer Divrei Hayamim Lemalchei Yisrael, etc. But the Midrash, you see at the bottom of the page, says Sefer HaYashar is really a reference to Sefer Bereshit, because it's the book of the people who are Yisharim, Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. So in other words, we're understanding that the mention of the sun and the moon standing still for Yehoshua is something that is already written about in Sefer Bereshit. And then the text testifies, V'lo haya kayom ha'hu l'fanad v'achara l'shmua v'lai v'kol ish, ki Adonai l'cham l'Yisrael. There never was before or since a time in which Hashem obeyed. The Shema B'kol means to obey the voice of a man, because God is fighting for Israel. In other words, Yeshua's command to God to make the sun and the moon stop was obeyed by God because God, and this is unprecedented, because God was fighting on behalf of Israel. Okay, that's the text. And now perhaps we get an inkling of what, how to understand the Shemesh and the Areach in Yosef's dream. Yosef dreamt that the sun, the stars are going to bow to him, we've already dealt with that, and that the sun and the moon will bow to him. Again, if the stars represent the children, and bowing represents dependence, and there's no reason for the hymn the Yosef in the dream not to be representative of the Yosef throughout the generations, Yosef's descendant who completes his job, which is Yehoshua. Of course, I will admit that this leaves one hole, because in this case, then the sun and the moon really are the sun and the moon and are not symbolic. But it's not necessary that everything be symbolic in the dream, as long as we allow for symbolism in, as part of our interpretation. What we've taken a look at over the course of the last 50 minutes is two broad difficulties in understanding the Yosef story with the dreams. The first piece was why Yosef felt that he could be a dream interpreter. And we looked back and saw the difficulties in the original interaction between Yosef and his brothers and his father in presenting the dreams, and we saw that evidently Yosef learned a lesson that when a dream is dreamt twice in succession, a similar dream, parallel dream, two people having a dream, that means that it's prophecy and that it should be fairly plain and easy to understand, and that's why he reacted the way he did to the butler and the baker and later on to Paro. The second piece of the puzzle was, of course, what do the dreams mean? And I pointed out that we should not be led in one direction because the spin that the brothers and later father give to the dreams, that's not necessarily what the dreams mean. The dreams are the dreams. Sheaves, sun, moon, and stars. What they mean? Lots of possibilities. We don't know. The brothers didn't know. Yaakov didn't know. Yosef himself didn't know. Perhaps Yosef only realized what the dreams meant years later when he's sitting on the throne of Egypt, dressed as an Egyptian regent with the name Sefer Paneach. The brothers come to him, suddenly realizes, aha, this is what the dreams mean. And now it's my job to take care of the family. Take care of the family, material subsistence, make sure they all come here so I can feed them, and then take care of the family in their spiritual success, and make sure that they get back to Eretz Yisrael. Yosef is unable to complete that job, and so Yosef, who lives 110 years, Yosef, who lives 110 years, again, the only one whose lifespan is mentioned twice, has a descendant who, not coincidentally, lives 110 years, Yehoshua ben Nun l'shevet Ephraim, who completes the job. Yosef's bones are only reinterred after Yehoshua's career is successfully completed, and Yehoshua is the one for whom the sun and the moon truly bow and truly obey when they stand still in his battle at Givon.